This is Civios, your source for public affairs research. A podcast from the Humphrey School of Public Affairs at the University of Minnesota.
I'm Melanie Summer with Civios, and today I'm welcoming the director of the Detainee Rights Clinic at the James Binger Center for New Americans at the University of Minnesota Law School, Professor Linus Chan. Professor Chan, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
And one of the things we wanted to talk about today was the Immigration Court Observation Project, which you are part of. Can you tell us what that means? What is the observation project?
Sure. Well, the project is designed to allow people in the community to go and observe detained immigration court hearings and during their observation collect information about what they observe and what they feel about the process of the immigration court.
How did this get started?
Well, it really began as a reaction, in fact, to what happened with the Muslim or travel ban that began in January of 2017. There was an outpouring of enthusiasm and interest and engagement. There were a number of people who were going out to the airports. A colleague of mine named Regina Jeffries really was one of the key people in organizing volunteers to go out to the airport to really kind of make sure that people were allowed to get off the airplanes and come into the United States when they were supposed to. When that died down, we were left, Advocates for Human Rights, Robbins Kaplan, and us were left with this outpouring of really enthused and engaged individuals who wanted to know how they can get involved and how they can continue to educate themselves about the immigration process. And that's sort of how the Immigration Court Observation Project really began its full-fledged project as we see it now.
And so what do these observers do, and number one? And number two, why is it important for them to be in these immigration courts?
Well, one of the hallmarks and one of the absolute tenets of both democratic ideals and a human rights perspective is the idea for a transparent process. And so many of the observers are going into court both to make sure that they can understand what's happening. So often, the only information that we hear about the immigration process is through the media. But this really gives us an opportunity, because these hearings are open to the public, to give a public a chance to see for themselves what the court process looks like. So observers would come in and they would observe hearings. Usually these are all detained hearings. And they happen over at Fort Snelling in the immigration court, generally about 4 days a week. And the observers would record their observations. And in their recording of their observations, they would continue to note what they see and give impressions of what they feel about the process. Court observation projects are not new. They've been a long tradition in human rights areas in other countries, and they've continued to have a tradition here in the United States, including immigration courts in the United States. What this project was shifted a little bit of the focus, however, was to shift to look at what the perceptions of what people thought was fair or not. Right. So in the past, we would have people and other court observation projects that have existed for the last decade and a half or so. They would be asked to record what were known as qualitative measures. Right. Was a person, did they have an attorney? What kind of bond were they set? What country are they from? Et cetera. And of course, our observers are still recording that data. But one of the things that had happened after we were receiving these questionnaires is we thought as a group that we really saw so much discourse in the media about the inequities and the unfairness and injustice. But we really thought it would be really powerful and important for the public themselves to have a say in what they thought. And it then has led us to really try to look at questions about whether they thought the people that were undergoing this process was given a fair process. What does it mean to be fair? What does it mean to be given procedural fairness?
What are some of those factors that the observers pay attention to?
Well, there's a number of things that looking at sociological, historical work that has looked at that is what's called engagement work. So looking at, for instance, whether or not they observed people being engaged in the process, or they observed whether or not proper information was being provided, whether they allow the people that were in the process to understand and to engage with the process itself. And of course, questions such as how neutral are the decision makers and what sort of ability that people had to bring forth their claims.
And will this continue for the foreseeable future, these court observations?
Yes, absolutely. It's wonderful, and absolutely one of the best things that's come out of this project was to see how organic and how the enthusiasm for people to want to engage in this participatory form of democracy is just very uplifting. It's really exciting to see how many people really want to see for themselves and really want to know for themselves what this process is like and want to be able to provide a viewpoint, a perspective about what this whole process is and whether or not it's fair.
And if people want to volunteer?
Yeah.
So how do they do that?
The Advocates for Human Rights is coordinating our volunteers and observers, and they have on their webpage a form that people can fill out and sign up. Right now, the interest has been so heavy that it's been difficult to find slots for people, to be quite frank. But it is, of course, something that we're always looking for people to help, not only through observations themselves, but quite frankly, we need help with putting in the data. It is something that we need help to put in data as well as to observe hearings. So that would be great.
Today we're going to be talking about the Human Rights Defender Project. And today I am here with Jack DeWard, who is an associate professor of sociology and graduate faculty at the Minnesota Population Center. Professor DeWard, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
How did you become involved with the Human Rights Defender Project?
Sure. I first became involved in the Human Rights Defender Project through a previous project that's actually still ongoing this year, an interdisciplinary collaborative workshop funded through the College of Liberal Arts called Migration and Migrants in Terrifying Times. We've spent the past 2 years delving into a number of migration topics of interest to faculty, staff, students, and community members on and off campus. At one of these meetings, I began talking with Professor Linus Chan in the Binger Center for New Americans at the law school about the Human Rights Defender Project and some of the data needs of that project.
And so as a social scientist, what's your role in this project?
Yes, that's a great question. There are an abundance of data that have been collected as part of the Human Rights Defender Project. One of the things that I have been working on with my graduate assistant, Chris Levesque, is to begin processing and cleaning those data, developing systems for doing that. The second piece that we've been working on is analyzing those data. And the third piece is sharing the results of those data with, first and foremost, the volunteers that have collected that information, but also with scholarly and other audiences.
Can you describe what it means when you say cleaning the data?
Yes. So the data are collected by court observation forms that our volunteers, which are the backbone of the Human Rights Defender Project, fill out in the courtroom. Electronic devices are not permitted in immigration court with the exception of devices carried by lawyers. What that means is that that information on the paper form must be transcribed and put into an electronic database outside of the courtroom. In that process, there is sometimes a potential for error in the sense that, for example, someone might enter a country name, Mexico, whereas someone else might refer to that country as MX. And so we need to clean the data to make those comparable.
That must be a lot of work.
It has been a lot of work over the past year, but thankfully we have had support with an internal grant from the Human Rights Initiative to support intensive work on this project.
Well, what have you learned so far from this data that you have been analyzing?
What I've learned so far is that the volunteers do an amazing job of collecting this information. When volunteers go into the courtroom, we are asking them to make subjective determinations about what they are seeing. Whether the judge, for example, treated the detained immigrant with respect, whether the detainee seemed engaged in the process. When our observers go into the courtroom, they are making those determinations based on their own perceptions, their own experiences, as any person would. At the same time, what results from that is it's very difficult to compare their responses to one another to make generalizable claims about 50%, 60%, 40% believe that the judge treated the detainee with respect. So part of my job is to see if we can make those data comparable across observers.
And how challenging is that?
It's extremely challenging. There are different methods for carrying this out. Those methods are combined with the data cleaning procedures, and those are combined with the court observation form and how that was originally set up at the beginning of the Human Rights Defender Project. So it's what I would call sort of a series of links in a chain where we have to start connecting all the pieces from start to finish to think about analyzing the data and eventually telling a story about perceptions of procedural fairness in immigration court.
Is this a common thing for researchers to do, is to take this sort of qualitative data and try to make it uniform?
It is a common thing for social scientists to do. The best analogy that I have comes from a different area of social science research, and it often comes up when we ask people to self-report their health. If you ask two people to self-report their health, they will draw from their own experiences, their own health experiences, which could be very different. Another way of saying that is they have different baselines, different starting points for providing an assessment of their self-reported health. The same is true when observers go into immigration court. They have different baselines, all of which are informed by their rich life histories and experiences. But at the same time, we have an issue with the comparability of responses that we also are concerned about, too.
What have you found rewarding or insightful or impactful about the research here, the analyzing of this data?
Well, it's important to mention that, as Linus discussed in his comments, that the Human Rights Defender Project has always been about getting community volunteers into the courtroom, participating in the democratic process. And that is really the main mission. And so what I've learned is how to combine in creative ways a program like that with, you know, avenues for where social science can come in and help and support. I have learned a lot about the importance of volunteers, the necessity of volunteers in that process along the way.
Well, what are the next steps then for you and your role in this project?
Well, my role in this project is sort of one component among many, given the mission of the Human Rights Defender Project as it was originally started. But that one component has a couple of ideas going forward. This past year, we submitted a grant proposal to the National Science Foundation to scale the work of the Human Rights Defender Project up, meaning to solidify what it does and make it long-lasting, improve, develop systems, to scale that up here in Minnesota, but also out to other cities, specifically Washington, D.C., Los Angeles, and Chicago. If that grant proposal is funded, then this would be the largest immigration court observation project ever conducted in the history of the United States.
And what do you think could be the result of having that research in several different communities?
Well, there are a number of different ways to respond to that question. One important one for me is that the American Bar Association has described the immigration court system as extremely dysfunctional. There are questions about the solvency of the immigration court system, given chronic underfunding. There are also questions about the legitimacy of the immigration court system. So third-party perceptions, external perceptions of procedural fairness and other court dynamics are absolutely imperative for interrogating and perhaps establishing, perhaps not, the legitimacy of the immigration court system.
What is the value of this partnership with the Human Rights Defender Project for your research, your teaching, and your service, your involvement here at the university?
I identify as an interdisciplinary scholar. That's very important to me, both professionally and personally, in part because the societal problems that we face, whether they're in the legal domain, outside of it, some combination, they don't respect disciplinary silos. So it is important to develop projects and develop collaborations that necessarily bleed across those divides. This project, this collaboration with the Human Rights Defender Project and the integration of a social science component with funding from the Human Rights Initiative is a great example, an exemplar, if you will, of projects that are trying to traverse those boundaries.
Do you know if other universities or other entities are doing this type of data analysis? If the grant is funded, would this be the first go-round in some of those other markets?
There have been other immigration court projects in the United States, some of which are ongoing. My understanding of those programs is they tend to start up. They have a short shelf life, and then they dissipate. That's what makes the Human Rights Defender Project somewhat unusual, is the lengthy shelf life, and indeed a shelf life that we're trying to ensure is sustainable over the long run. So in that sense, the Human Rights Defender Project is a different court observation project than a number of others, some of which have come from advocacy and community organizations, other which have come from think tanks and other centers associated with universities.
This project has relied, as we've talked about, on volunteers who are willing to take the time to visit the immigration court and record their observations. What is it that has most impressed you about that effort?
What I've noticed about the volunteers is they're thoroughly committed to being present in the courtroom and watching, and they do that in a host of really wonderful ways. We have volunteers that are completing the court observation forms. Volunteers that on top of their time in the courtroom, which is a several-hour block of time on a regular basis, are inputting their data electronically, transferring that for us and assisting with that data preparation process. We have also hosted several open houses where we have talked to the volunteers about what they need to see in the courtroom, what would be helpful to them, and also solicited their input for grant proposals. Volunteers have graciously offered their time in all of those capacities.
Today I am joined by Chris Levesque, who is a doctoral student in sociology and a research assistant with Professor Linus Chan and Professor Jack DeWard on the Human Rights Defender Project. Chris, you are basically the person who is doing much of the data analysis that has been collected so far through this project.
That's right.
Can you tell us a little bit about what you have observed so far? What are your main takeaways from that data?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, there are two main takeaways that we're thinking about and want to keep researching. First focuses more on the demographics of who we're studying, who's migrating to the United States, where are they coming from? Why are they in immigration court to begin with? What crimes did they commit or what are they being charged with? Also thinking about family relations, like who's here in the United States with them. The second component thinks more about what observers are actually seeing in the courtroom and what they think is fair and what they think is unfair. So speaking more to the first part, we see that most of the respondents or detainees are coming from Mexico and then also from Central America. In line with that, the majority of respondents' preferred language is Spanish, and then we also see English beginning in second, and then we also see a lot of indigenous languages, often which are not accommodated for in court. So what's interesting here is that in some cases, interpreters are not available for indigenous speakers. So even by telephone, and even with the judge reassuring them that they could postpone their court date for a later date. It's concerning that there's an interpreter shortage, given that there are a number of indigenous languages, especially in Central America, that have become some of the most common languages spoken in immigration court in the past few years. And we also found that at times, phone interpreters were unable to fully interpret the hearing, with judges and attorneys sometimes being unaware when to pause and when to keep going. And also, what's really interesting is that more than half of the respondents show up without an attorney present. And when the job falls upon the shoulders of the respondent to find and pay for an attorney, the process can quickly become unfair for those who are facing deportation. One other thing that I wanted to bring up was that common charges and convictions often include DUIs, traffic violations, and driving without a license. So oftentimes these sort of petty crimes which in criminal court would be less punitive. But because you're in immigration court and because you're a non-citizen, showing up without an attorney, deportation can become one of the most terrible punishments imaginable. And then speaking to my second point, do observers actually think that the immigration court process is fair? We find that while observers have different interpretations about whether judges and attorneys are fair and just, most observers doubt that the institution of immigration court itself promotes unbiased outcomes and that those outcomes comport with a sense of justice. So observers often note how legal actors, you know, judges, attorneys, clerks, etc., are sympathetic human beings that are wrapped up in the chaotic and untenable bureaucratic process that is immigration court. Many observers describe the judges especially as kind, helpful, professional, and patient. And they take time to explain the process to a respondent, especially when they are tried without an attorney. However, other observers describe judges as impatient. And another wrote that a judge was frustrated that the detainee was not prepared with an attorney. So within these observations, one can see how judges' decisions can create openings for resolutions between the law and non-citizen subjects, but can also bind them to processes of removal and exclusion.
Could you explain what would cause someone to have to appear in immigration court? What are the circumstances under which they might be in court?
Yeah, so there are common charges and convictions that people are often picked up for, including DUIs, traffic violations, and driving without a license. There's also things like simple battery and theft and failing to appear in court. And non-citizens may have committed these crimes many years ago, but ICE picks them up after they've served out their sentences and then puts them in a deportation holding cell, even if they've proceeded to lead productive and law-abiding lives. And for people who have spent years, decades, potentially generations in the United States, who have developed strong community and family ties in their neighborhood, deportation is one of the most terrible punishments one can imagine.
What is the value of having that quantitative information that you talked about, as well as the qualitative information from the volunteers?
Well, both are certainly valuable. Because on the one hand, we use observation forms, which lend a sort of quantitative rigor and a firm basis for generalization. But on the other hand, we also want volunteers to write their impressions down in a more open-ended section. That provides more interpretive richness to what we're studying. For instance, in Bloomington Immigration Court, it's a common sight to see a defendant sitting by themselves, wearing an orange jumpsuit, ankle shackled underneath the table. And oftentimes they, which is usually a male, sit alone without an attorney by their side. And using a mixed methods approach, which integrates both quantitative and qualitative research, allows us to focus in on what is the paradox to this scenario, which is that despite the hearing falling outside the criminal realm of the law, migrant defendants often tried for their past criminal convictions and charges in such a way that denies them of their life, liberty, and property.
Have you noticed any patterns in terms of analyzing the data? Is there a difference, for example, if the defendant, as it were by themselves or had an attorney or had a family member in the courtroom with them?
Definitely. Our observers can speak to that as well. You know, sociologists have studied the past couple of years and found that attorney representation in immigration court is a net positive for defendants. Attorneys can help them file legal paperwork in time, can help them provide legal evidence that matters to their case, and also provide arguments in favor of them staying. Often when there's a government attorney who knows the ins and outs of immigration law sitting right across the corner. So that certainly matters. And that also applies to family members. While they don't necessarily have any legal expertise, they certainly provide moral support and an extra eye in the courtroom for which judges and attorneys are all aware of.
How does the data that you're collecting here in Minnesota relate to information that is being gathered in immigration courts and other places around the country?
Yeah, so there are two main points here. First, there's a wonderful set of publicly available data online from the folks at TRAC, which is TRAC. It stands for the Transactional Records Access Clearinghouse, based out of Syracuse University. And we've been comparing our Bloomington, Minnesota data with what they have at TRAC, which is nationally representative and much more all-encompassing. And we find that our numbers tend to match up with theirs. Just like everywhere else, we see long wait times, sometimes taking years for a defendant to see their case through. And we also see similar bond and relief outcomes. More can be done to make sense or at least shed light on the chaos that is immigration court. Our observers found a number of procedural due process issues that a recent American Bar Association report has also brought up. namely an increasing reliance on video teleconferencing technology and also a shortage of qualified interpreters, which I also referred to earlier, especially for cases involving respondents whose primary language is uncommon or a regional indigenous dialect.
How important is it that this data is being collected by third-party observers as opposed to the lawyers or the judges or the people who are involved in the court proceedings themselves?
Well, first, I think that community-based research involving court observation can be a useful resource for understanding how third-party responses pay attention to how legal actors such as judges offer respect, provide engagement, help explain phenomena related to the criminalization of immigrants. Second, third-party observation can build on recent work in sociology that looks at attorney representation and judicial decision-making in removal and bond hearings. It also engages historians, social scientists, and legal scholars' work on topics such as due process violations in immigration court. And lastly, and maybe most importantly, it contributes to this idea that public perceptions of fairness lead to promoting legitimacy and holding courts accountable to maintain compliance with law enforcement norms.
What would you like to see happen with the data that you're collecting and analyzing right now?
I think first and foremost, accountability. I think our observers are of the same mindset. They are showing up to immigration court for a reason. It's not that the data just ends up in a repository somewhere. It's that people are actually analyzing it and using it to their advantage. And I think lawyers are very interested, too, to see what the court observers have to say. And the benefit of having social scientists in the room is that we're able to analyze that data and work with lawyers and volunteers and other sort of advocates to make sense of what immigration court actually means. Because in some ways, and this is what a legal historian, Lucy Salyer, once said, immigration law is the outlaw of all American laws.
What do you mean by that?
What I would say is this. Immigration court needs to be demystified because in some ways, despite it being out in the public realm and anybody can attend whenever they want to, there are so many processes and procedures to it that it often doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense to the detainee. It oftentimes doesn't make sense to their family members. And even for our volunteer observers when they're starting out, it takes a little bit of time to get adjusted to what immigration means and how it is defined in the law. What observers can do for us is they provide us observations that are really rich in detail and have these amazing vignettes and observations. And we need to stretch it out and put it back together again in order for the general public to make sense of it and decide for themselves what needs to be acted upon and how to fix this broken immigration system.
Chris Levesque, thank you very much for joining us and talking about your research.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to another podcast from Civios, an initiative of the Humphrey School of Public Affairs at the University of Minnesota. To learn more about this segment, please visit civios.umn.edu.